This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it's October and the seasonal clock is changing. Autumn's in the air and up here in New England, the leaves are turning. If you're down in Washington, you're marking time as the federal fiscal year just begins on October 1st. And in the world, everyone is keeping an eye on the announcements every day that come out early in October about the Nobel Prizes. And across our country, there's celebration about National Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
Well, Mark, the Nobel Prize announcements I always find incredibly exciting and uplifting, and the many local marches and events in honor of National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, moving and powerful. But the view in Washington, I'm not quite sure what to make of it because it looks like another showdown at the OK Corral. We've just passed another resolution that will keep us going until November 18th. Then we have to do it again, and that'll be the third time on the federal budget. And healthcare funding, of course, seems to be front and center. The proposed Republican bill would clearly prohibit the Obama administration from spending the money it needs to carry out the healthcare reform until all legal challenges to it are resolved. And that's going to be very problematic for the Obama administration.
Well, they have brought the legal challenges front and center, as they did last week, asking the Supreme Court to rule on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. And that's probably going to happen before the federal elections in 2012, in November. And yet the court is also addressing other health issues. They have California's case, which is really focused in on a state's rights to adjust its Medicaid payments to providers. But both the Medicaid patients and healthcare providers are suing California, arguing that the cuts violate federal law requiring payments sufficient to assure access to quality care. We'll keep an eye on that as well.
And, you know, Medicaid has always had issues across the country with ensuring access to care, not just having it be insurance that doesn't get people the care they need. And I think we'll be talking to a guest in the near future about that, sort of a fascinating history of how Medicaid ended up being so different from Medicare.
Margaret, my 14-year-old daughter went out the other day and had her hair dyed pink in recognition of the National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And, you know, we've seen some of our staff all nicely recognizing the various health promotions that are happening in terms of domestic violence and breast cancer awareness that are going on. And in the breast cancer awareness, it's been 25 years since women and men have been organized around making sure that treatment is available for everyone.
And kudos to all of the people we know who work so hard on outreach in the neighborhoods, making sure that screening is available and making sure that care is available when problems are found. And on the front lines of all these health battles and all these health challenges and some of the health victories are our nation's nurses. This week, we're delighted to be joined by Dr. Linda Akin, one of the country's most influential nurse leaders, well known for her groundbreaking research linking nurse-patient ratios with not just patient safety, but with survival and mortality.
And no matter what the story, you can always find out about our shows by Googling us at CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Now, before we check with Dr. Akin, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, for the headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. The Supreme Court opened up its new term this week with a key Medicaid case in California. The issue concerns the question of whether those who provide care and receive benefits under Medicaid can go to court when a state tries to cut spending on the program. Mainly, the justices are concerned with the question of whether the providers and Medicaid recipients were entitled to sue over the move. Back in 2008, the state of California cut its reimbursement rate for the program by 10%. Medicaid and health care providers sued the state, arguing that the cuts violated federal law requiring payments sufficient to access quality care. A survey of social workers, nurses, and doctors working for the Department of Veterans Affairs finds that more than 70% of respondents think the department lacks the staff and space to meet the needs of the growing numbers of veterans seeking mental health care. More than 37% of the 272 respondents say they cannot schedule an appointment in their clinic for a new patient within the 14-day standard mandated by the department. A copy of the survey was obtained by the Washington Post, and the story appeared in the paper early this week.
Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Linda Akin, one of the country's most influential nurse leaders. Dr. Akin is the Claire M. Fagan Leadership Professor in Nursing, also a professor of sociology, as well as the director of the Center for Health Outcomes and Policy Research at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. Welcome, Dr. Akin.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Yeah, you know, you've strived throughout your career to see the bigger picture for the nursing profession, both here and abroad. And important focus of your work has been addressing shortages in the number of available nurses. I think most of the folks that I know are either going into nursing or talking about it. Maybe from your vantage point, just set the stage. Is the shortage problem on the wane, or is there still lots of work to be done?
Well, we've made tremendous progress in terms of increasing enrollments in nursing schools. They've actually almost doubled since 1994, from 75,000 then to over 130,000 new graduates in nursing every year in the U.S. And so that's beginning to make a dent in that shortage in the future that we're concerned about. And, of course, also, the recession, you know, has affected both the use of care and has resulted in people in nursing spending more time than they might otherwise in employment. So at the moment, things are in pretty good balance. But it looks like, of course, in the future, because we have an aging population, we have more chronic illness, we have scientific innovations that are bringing us more treatments, and the public's expectations are always growing, that there will be an increased demand for health care and therefore a nursing shortage in the future.
Dr. Akin, there's the shortage of nurses in the general sense, right, the number of nurses available in the profession, but your research is particularly important and well-known in the area of a shortage in the specific situation of the number of nurses available to care for a number of patients on any particular unit at any particular time. So this issue of the shortage in the ratio of nurses to patients, mm-hmm. you've shown to have a direct impact on mortality and outcomes for patients. Can you tell our listeners about this research? And there's probably a number of questions we'd like to explore a little deeper with you in that area, but maybe you could lay that out for our listeners.
Okay, well, there's now a scientific consensus from over 100 rigorous studies on hospital nurse staffing that patient outcomes of all kinds are better when nurses care for fewer patients each. So specifically, our large-scale research in the U.S. and abroad shows that on average, each additional patient that's added to a hospital nurse's workload results in a 7% increase in hospital deaths, even for common surgeries.
You know, there's this strong trend that we also talk a lot on our show about transparency, along with the issues of quality and safety, and have looked at this from many lenses. And I wonder, just before we maybe move on to some other areas, the issue of transparency from the patient and the patient family experience. I know there's been some legislation introduced in states. I don't know whether that's been successful in having hospitals actually post their ratios, communicating to families and patients what that ratio is relative to what the desired or the norm is. And as we look at issues like how do patients decide what hospital they're going to go to, how does the informed consumer make decisions or understand what this means to them and to their loved ones?
Well, we're really making progress now on providing information to consumers. I think one of the most important resources has been made available by the Medicare program, and it's a website called Hospital Compare. There's also a similar website for nursing homes and home care. Of course, the other thing that I always encourage people to do is to see if they have a magnet hospital in their community. A magnet hospital is a form of voluntary accreditation for excellence in care with a particular focus on excellence in nursing and having safe nurse staffing ratios. And again, the consumer can Google Magnet Hospital and find the name of every Magnet Hospital in the country.
Well,
now, about 400 hospitals are Magnet, which is about 7% of all hospitals.
Well, let me say that we're in a hometown where our local hospital, Middlesex Hospital, we'll put a little plug in for them, has received the Magnet Award for Nursing Excellence 3 times in a row. And let me say, they shout that from the mountain.
So do we.
So do we. And talk to us a little more about that whole process, though, for accreditation, because we want, I think we want all hospitals to both celebrate and be part of the educational process to understand the value that nurses are playing. And it's really, as you described it, about outcomes, right? The role that nurses are playing are really critical to successful management of very complicated cases, and they can yield successful outcomes.
Well, yes, and the derivation of the Magnet Hospital idea came from a lot of data that showed that, you know, outcomes in our hospitals are not as nearly as good as what they should be.
Yes.
The Institute of Medicine estimated that deaths from medical error, one of the 5 leading causes of death in our country. And so a lot of research on why that is has taken place. And one of the major factors that we find in our program of research in the U.S. and other places is that the work environments in hospitals are commonly very poor. And the Institute of Medicine points to the poor work environments as a major factor in the high rate of medical error. So nurses in particular have been really looking at best practices that lead to a better work environment in hospitals that could be operationalized in some kind of a roadmap, so that you could give hospitals this roadmap and they could get from point A, which might not be as good as they could be, to point B, which would be much better. And then there's a lot of research that shows that if hospitals improve their work environments, that patient outcomes improve and also nurse retention at the bedside improves. So these evidence-based best practices have been identified over the past 3 decades, and they comprise the Magnet program. But to give you a couple of examples of what those things are: a flat organizational structure, meaning there's not a lot of hierarchy in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Nurses involved, at least the chief nurse in the top decision-making group, including the board of directors, which is not simply bringing nursing perspective, but nurses are probably the best advocate for patients. So by having a nurse in the top decision-making group, you're getting a patient perspective. The involvement of clinical nurses in bedside decision-making, the requirement by management of good nurse-physician collaboration relationships, and, for example, there, the Joint Commission, which is the most prevalent form of accreditation for hospitals, has developed a policy of zero tolerance for bullying in the workplace because it's dangerous for patient safety. So there are a series of these requirements that have a big evidence base behind them that show that if hospitals have these things, that outcomes for patients are better and nurse retention is better.
Dr. Akin, your influence is certainly extremely broad, and your research portfolio is also very broad. And I understand you've received a grant to study the impact of nursing care on outcomes for chronically ill and minority patients. We, as you know, run a large community health center statewide here in Connecticut, and of course that's a huge concern for us. Can you tell us a little bit about that work, and also perhaps the degree to which under the Affordable Care Act this kind of work, both moving hospitals to magnet status, improving ratios of nursing, focusing on the chronically ill, your perspective on the degree to which the health reform bill really supports these activities?
Well, I think there are sort of 2 big subdivisions. One has to do with this continuing agenda of patient safety, which we need throughout healthcare in every setting, but is particularly important in a hospital. So on that front, we our research is now turning very specifically to looking at the business case for higher quality in healthcare, especially as it relates to nursing, and the policy changes that would be needed to support more cost-effective use of nurses. So just as for example, I've mentioned that having more nurses in hospitals leads to better outcomes for patients. Hospitals pay the salaries of the nurses, and research shows that more nurses reduces, for example, hospital readmissions. But the cost savings of preventing a future admission for a patient benefits the insurers like Aetna or Medicare, mm-hmm. but not really the hospital, because the hospital actually loses money because you're preventing a future readmission. So payment policies need to be modified to reward hospitals for better outcomes. So we're trying to create the business case for that change managerially and from a policy perspective. Then in the ambulatory side, we're working to provide the evidence that suggests that nurses could have a more expanded role in primary care in particular, and if they did, there would be many benefits to patients in terms of more accessible care and more affordable care. And this is an area that we particularly need to work on to improve both the quality and access of care to the chronically ill and minorities.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Linda Akin, one of the country's most influential nurse leaders. You know, we're interested in sort of the intersection of two forces, and you just talked about minority nurses, and we run, as Margaret said, a community health center, and so we're concerned about, are there enough subsidies available to support folks who are trying to obtain nursing degrees and that represent the diversity that we serve and the patients in the broader community. And then something you've been talking about the sufficient number of faculty available to sort of meet the demands to train this generation. So tell us about who owns this responsibility and who's going to solve it? Is this a federal, state, local? Is it private sector? Who's going to sort of adjudicate the set of structural issues that are out there?
Well, really, the answer to this problem and dilemma has got to be a joint effort of local communities, states, and the federal government. Nurses pay for their education in the U.S. Now, many people would say, well, don't most people pay for their education? If you look at other countries, most nursing education is actually paid for by government because nurses are thought of as a public good. Hmm. So that's not the case in the U.S. where nurses pay for their own education. So the answer to the question, is there enough support for minorities and other folks to actually access higher education, which is required for nursing? The answer is no. Mm-hmm. That we really have a very inadequate public support at all of these different levels for nursing education. We do have now a very large demand for nursing as a career, which is a very good thing for the country, but we're turning away about 30,000 qualified applicants every year for nursing school. So if we're looking at a future shortage, certainly not in the public interest not to make it possible for all those 30,000 people that are qualified and want to be nurses to actually access higher education and become nurses. You know, in the past, the nursing shortage has been a result of not enough Americans wanting to be nurses. So we've overcome that huge problem. Now the challenge is access to care, to education for those who want to be nurses. Now, part of the reason we're turning away so many qualified applicants is their capacity limitations, because we haven't been funding higher education at a high enough rate in our states, localities, and at the federal level to really make it possible for all the people that want to be nurses to get into these schools. So almost all the state universities, for example, have a limitation on, you know, how many nursing majors, you know, they can accept because of the cost of nursing education. So we need some help for mm-hmm. The nursing schools from public subsidies to allow them to expand. We also have a problem on the faculty shortage side, and this relates to the character of or organization of nursing education in the country. Two-thirds of all the nurses now become nurses by getting their education at a community college. Now, we know from our research that only about 20% of graduates of community colleges in nursing go on to get a higher degree. A higher degree, really a master's degree or higher, is required for every faculty member, be it in a junior college or a four-year institution. So there you have almost two-thirds of people coming into nursing who will never have the qualification to be a faculty. So we don't really, because of this great access of community colleges and the associate degree, have enough nurses that can qualify over time. So one of the proposals is, this has been a major recommendation of the Institute of Medicine, is by the year 2020, 80% of all nurses in the country should have a baccalaureate degree. And that will require funders, federal, state, and local, to step up to make that happen.
So, Dr. Aiken, you referenced the Institute of Medicine, and I'd like to go to another point in the Institute of Medicine. I think we've spoken in previous shows about their Future of Nursing report and their 8 key recommendations. And one of those is about developing at the new RN level nurse residency programs in hospitals. And we've been very focused on the graduate level. You may know we started the country's first nurse practitioner residency program for primary care nurses who are going to practice in community health centers. But at the new nurse level, one of the arguments has been that we have the issue of qualified candidates being turned away. We have the numbers graduating, but then we have another contributor to the problem, which is too many new nurses leave within the first year, leave within the first 2 years. And many have proposed that it's the absence of a structured support in the form of nurse residencies that really would bridge that transition from education to practice. What's the state of the science on that in terms of research showing whether this is really a reasonable solution to that problem?
Well, we have some beginning evidence and more research underway that suggests that retention of new graduates is helped by these residency programs for new nurses. I think the challenge is who has responsibility for financing these residency programs. When we talk about residencies for doctors, we're talking about really graduate-level residencies, people that have finished their full education, and the federal government pays a large share of residency training for doctors. There's a question about whether it will be possible to have widespread residencies for nurses if the federal government and state governments don't play a role. But then here we have the dilemma of whether these residencies paid for by public funds should be for nurse practitioners at the higher level, which would be more comparable to what public policy does in the case of physicians. And then that would predominantly leave these residency programs for new nurses to be the responsibility of employers, because they would be the ones that would benefit from the higher retention rates of these new graduates. So that's one of the dilemmas of where do we go in financing, because as I mentioned, there are 130,000 new graduates a year. That's a pretty big price for a residency program if we would think about every new nurse having one.
Well, Dr. Aiken, we would like to ask all of our guests this final question, and I suspect you could answer it in many ways and at great length. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
I think they should be keeping an eye on nurses. you might expect me to say this.
It was good to say.
But if you look at where the innovations are coming from now in healthcare, they're all coming out of nurses, nursing, because nurses have the kind of closest perception of the impact of health and illness on patients, and they're the spokespeople for that. Actually, a very interesting little footnote here in the Philadelphia Magazine, we have a top docs issue every year, and we kind of look for it because obviously Penn docs get in it often. And so this year, the top doc in Philadelphia's magazine is a nurse.
Oh, wonderful. That's really wonderful. And yeah. And Philadelphia is certainly a locus of exemplary nurse leaders and nurses.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. Linda Akin, one of the country's most influential nurse leaders. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our community and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on a movement that's transforming small corner stores across the country.
We decided to start one here in New Haven, and essentially we work with the corner store owners, and in exchange for them offering some healthier items in their store, we provide some monetary incentives and also some technical assistance and access to other resources that they might not otherwise get.
Elisa Santilli helps direct Yale's Community Alliance for Research and Engagement, one of the latest to sign on to healthy corner store initiatives. In New Haven and in many inner cities across the country, corner stores outnumber traditional groceries where fresh produce and healthy food is not available. But with the help of community resources and organizations banding together, store owners can step up and sell healthier snacks to their customers. Things like apples, oranges, and granola bars instead of chips and packaged cookies. Since Yale became part of the program back in May, 4 corner stores in New Haven have begun providing healthier options. The hope is to get 3 or 4 more stores on board in the next 8 months, a campaign that's making a big impact on community health, corner store by corner store. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.